mutually assured destruction, cultural style. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Great to be back with you, Barry. I've just finished up some heavy work.
You did.
And essentially, I'm recovering from that while we talk on the air. I've just been through another experience, though, that I found myself fuming and pounding the table and saying all kinds of interesting things. Nothing bad, but wow and unbelievable and a number of those kinds of exclamations came out of me while I was doing this. Now, many of you know that I'm a member of a church, Providence Presbyterian OPC in Pataskal, Ohio. I'm an elder there, and one of the duties of the elder is to decide church policy. And some of you have different setups for that, church board or whatever. But the elders in a Presbyterian church decide the church policy. So we have to keep abreast of things that are going on. And we all know about what has been called. There are a number of names for it, the Obergefell decision. And the one that really bothers me the most is the marriage equality decision by the Supreme Court. This has nothing. There is no such thing as marriage equality. There's only marriage.
That's true.
Basically, marriage between two members of the same sex isn't marriage at all. It's what Doug Wilson likes to call mirage. He calls it same-sex mirage because it is a mirage. It is not a marriage. It's not a union consecrated before God, and it can't be because God designed marriage and defined it specifically as one man, one woman for life. And there are exceptions to that for life rule. But for the most part, it is one man, one woman for life. And anything else is a counterfeit. Well, one of the things I was required to do as an elder was to watch a video from my church insurance company on this issue about how to protect our church and how to protect our pastor and basically how to protect the elders from possible discrimination suits and that kind of thing. And I'll be quite honest, it was an exercise in frustration because the things we were told in the video Now again, I would say that this man is supposedly an expert in his field. It was given by an attorney who was a Harvard Law School graduate and also attended Harvard Divinity School. So supposedly he is an expert on church and legal matters coming before courts, having to do with churches, having to do with the First Amendment. And as we know with the First Amendment, it doesn't say what a lot of people think it says. There's no phrase in there that has anything to do with separation of church and state. What it does, though, is guarantee the right to freedom of religion and the free exercise thereof. And I would posit, and perhaps Barry would as well, that the free exercise of religion includes the right to determine what the scriptures do say and how they should be implemented, especially within the walls of our own churches.
Well, absolutely. I think that that's just really common sense in most instances, Chuck, that that whole right of religious liberty is that you can hold to the tenets of your faith, you can practice the tenets of your faith, and you can operate in the realm of your doctrinal beliefs without being molested or compromised or halted in those beliefs by government.
And just so we don't, a lot of people love to do the straw man argument. Does that mean you can do human sacrifice inside the walls of your church?
Okay, well, show me a legitimate religious expression that allows human sacrifice
And see, that key word is legitimate.
Legitimate, that's right. Now, and then the argument would be, well, who then decides what's legitimate?
God.
God, exactly.
Yeah, and that's the problem you run into, Barry. One of the problems we've run into here, and this is kind of off topic again.
Well, that's okay. This is going to be a range of topics.
Yeah, I was going to say. One of the problems you run into is the fact that people who want to subtract God and only go with natural law. They don't want to use revealed law. They want to use natural law. And one of the problems you run into there is when you go back and try to reference God as your source, oh, you can't do that. This is the Radical Two Kingdoms movement. You'll hear it basically touted as simply the two kingdoms. That's not really the two kingdoms philosophy. The two kingdoms philosophy is the idea that we live both, we are citizens of both the world and heaven.
That's right.
That we have currently. I have a friend who you always used to say, "Where do you live?" And he would say, "Well, I'm a citizen of heaven." Well, yes, you're building a house there now, but right now you live here.
That's right. Right now you're residing here.
And where is that? You know, I was asking simply was, where do you live? You know, I was trying to find out if we had anything mutual. You know, so. You run into problems when you subtract God out of the equation, because when you go back and say, well, when you get the question, who's the final arbiter of what is legitimate? Well, the answer is God.
Exactly.
Now, this is one of the problems you run into when you reject what Barry and I would call, we didn't call it this. We call it this because this is what it is. Presuppositional apologetics.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
In presuppositional apologetics, the idea is that God exists, period. It's the basis.
Right, exactly.
It's the basis of all argumentation. In fact, the idea is that if God doesn't exist, then you have no basis to make arguments for any point, let alone the point that God doesn't exist. And what I mean by that is logical thought is impossible without the existence of God. And atheists will jump up and down and say, that's not true, blah, 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 blah. Well, okay, if logic is simply the somehow ordered result of the firing of particular brain cells in a specific order, well, the question then is, why do they fire in that specific order?
Well, that's a good question.
The question is, why do they fire at all? And the question gets even further back, why are there brain cells? In fact, why are there cells? Why is there matter? And where did matter and energy come from?
You're confusing me now.
Yeah. Because when you presuppose all these things, you presuppose matter, you presuppose energy, you presuppose order.
This is correct.
In matter and energy. Well, you don't get to do that because matter and energy have to follow law.
But aren't I the lawmaker?
Uh-huh. That's the problem.
Uh-huh.
If you were the lawmaker, we could all go zap and have everything we wanted. We could create our own universe. We could, on days when traffic's really bad, we could all say, you know, oingo boingo, illy, you know, eeny weeny chili beanie, and create our own universe that only we reside in. Or perhaps we and our wife and children, or who knows, in, you know, the Miss America and I could move into our universe together. But it doesn't work that way. There is a set of laws in the universe, and the laws come from someplace. Now, some people, I've had the argument given to me that laws come from matter itself or energy itself. And I'm like, okay, that doesn't work either, because the question then is, where did matter and energy come from? Well, the answer that you get in someone who is giving you a what we would call a materialist presupposition is that they just are.
They just are.
They just are. They exist. We know they exist. We can touch them, feel them, taste them, hear them, use all our senses. And I would say that is an article of faith.
Well, of course. Absolutely.
Because
it has to be.
As you reject my faith, you are adopting your own. So in other words, you are adopting my worldview to make yours make sense. Because you, by faith, believe that these things exist because you can see them, hear them, taste them, smell them, by the way, the only reason you have those senses is because you have a body and a brain and nerve endings, which presuppose the existence of matter and energy, which presuppose the existence of order. And you're claiming that random processes built order. That's a major problem.
Well, yes, because the nature of random means that there is no order. So to presuppose randomness means order is along the lines of being a postmodernist, because words don't have meaning anymore.
Now, how did I get down this rabbit trail?
You know, it's not a rabbit trail. I got a glimpse of where you're going.
Yeah, so. Because what I'm saying is that laws are not
fixed points in midair.
That's
right. They have to be grounded in something solid.
They have to have some kind of a solid foundation that goes back to a specific point. The whole problem with the Obergefell decision, the Mirage Equality decision, is the fact that it has no concrete foundation. In fact, when we get into this, we're going to discuss the fact that one of the things that's being looked at is what comes after this. Because this decision left the door wide open. I mean wide open for any kind of perversion of God's plan for marriage that you can imagine.
And some they wouldn't even be able to imagine.
No. That's kind of the point. The people who founded the United States of America could not possibly have envisioned this.
This is one thing that the founding fathers weren't prescient on.
Right.
However, they did do some presupposing of their own.
They certainly did.
And they presupposed, well, what was normal in the colonies at the time was the fact that the vast majority of the colonists held to some branch of Orthodox faith.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, it's even reflected in the signers to the Constitution, because of those signers, I think 55 signers, there are only two of them whose faith practices are unknown, and only two others of them whose faith practices were actually called into question, i.e. the whole deist argument about Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin. So, Jefferson didn't even sign the Constitution. He wasn't part of that.
Right. I've gotten that argument a lot. What about Jefferson? I'm like,
well,
since he was ambassador to France at the time, he was a little busy. He wasn't in Philadelphia. One of those guys whose religious affiliation is not known is suspected because he's buried in a churchyard.
Yes, and in that time period, you could not be buried in a churchyard unless you
were an active member of the church.
Member of the church. And professing didn't mean, hey, I showed up and I threw a tithe check in the plate about once a month. You actually had to go through examinations, and you had to show yourself approved. In other words, they had higher standards than we do now.
Yeah, exactly. So the fact is that the founders had no idea, really. I mean, they could foresee bad things coming, which is why they built checks and balances into the Constitution. But the whole point of the Obergefell decision is that it has completely turned the checks and balances of the Constitution on its head. Now, what do I mean by completely turned it on its head? Okay, the idea that the courts could take an amendment, that's Amendment 14, which says nothing about marriage. It says absolutely nothing about marriage.
Not at all.
What it's for is to provide people with equal access to the law.
Well, that's true. But what it's been used for
exactly
is a club to do two things. To number one, to force the application of the first 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights, which were limitations upon the federal Congress
right.
and the federal government, to force that interpretation upon the states. interesting thing. There's still that thing called the 10th Amendment there, which basically is it mucks up the works a little bit on that issue. But the courts try to, they act like the 10th Amendment has actually become null and void, and it's just sitting there as a bridge placeholder between the real Bill of Rights, which is what they determine it is, and the 14th Amendment. So it extends that and forces the states to have to provide the same set of privileges, because at the federal level it's rights, at the lower level it's privileges against government, or government now against the people. And also it opened the door to extending many of the other clauses of the constitutions in areas that they were never intended to be extended
exactly.
to.
Exactly. And okay, let's talk. I don't know if this is the proper place or not, but this is where I'm broaching the subject.
Oh, fired up. That's good.
When we talk about the Mirage Equality decision, a decision had to come before it that built the bridge that supposedly provides the link on which they could build the bridge to Obergefell. And that was the decision to negate the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, also called the DOMA. Now, if you read the decision, the way they did it was essentially, they didn't say this per se, but here's what they did. They declared Article 4 of the Constitution unconstitutional.
Yes, that's exactly what they did.
And they did it using the 14th Amendment.
Yes.
So basically what they're saying is that the 14th Amendment, which was designed to give former slaves equal access to the law. What they did was they claimed that it wiped out the 10th Amendment, wiped out the 9th Amendment, wiped out the Article 4 of the Constitution now, and several other articles of the Constitution have essentially been wiped out on the basis of the 14th Amendment.
Right.
So what they're claiming is that the 14th Amendment took the Constitution and completely rewrote it. Because that's what they've done with Obergefell. They've completely rewritten the Constitution by judicial fiat.
True.
They essentially amended the Constitution using an existing amendment. And now look where we are. We now stand on a precipice, looking down.
Yeah, that's a deep drop.
What's coming? Well, multiple marriage.
Yep.
Multiple partner marriage.
Polygamy. Yes.
That's actually, in fact, there is a lawsuit getting ready to crank up in Nevada. If you've all, I'm trying to think what channel it's on. I think it's on the Learning Channel or maybe it's on Learning Channel or Discovery. It's called Sister Wives.
Mm-hmm. I don't know what channel it's on. But
it's on one of the channels. It's the guy that has, I think he had five wives, and one of his wives said, okay, I'm out of here. Of course, he's not legally married to all but one of them, and I think the legal marriage is the one that took off. Yeah. But he has all these wives, and he is now ginning up a lawsuit based on the Obergefell decision to say you can no longer restrict marriage to two partners.
There you go. There it is. It's coming.
And of course, the Supreme Court can hold out by creating some kind of weird mumbo jumbo and doing a dance around, backwards around while throwing strange powder into a fire. But the fact is that if using their own legal arguments from Obergefell, they're going to have no choice but to find in favor of polygamous marriage.
Well, absolutely, because they basically said, and that was some of the arguments that the dissent opinions in that decision from Justice John Roberts, the Chief Justice, from Antonin Scalia, from Clarence Thomas, their arguments, and Samuel Alito, who were the four dissenting justices in the case, their arguments painted this picture clearly. You have now created a scenario where there is no bright line. There's no place that we can stop this at this point. They didn't say that exactly in
right.
that language. But what they basically said was, this ball is now rolling downhill and there's no stopping it until it gets to where it wants to go. And since we know that the natural state of man without Christ is evil continually, the heart is deceitful and desperately wicked and above all else, and who can know it, and that we are born into sin as our natural curse state, and that there, as the Roman says, there is none righteous, no, not one. And we know where that ball is going to stop.
Yeah.
At the lowest possible pit it can possibly stop at before somebody dies. So no, and then I don't even think that'll stop it.
No, that won't stop it.
Because there will be, in order to create benefits or whatever, if that's the argument they want to use now, instead, if the love argument doesn't work, it's the benefits argument that comes up as far as this whole thing about equal protection. Well, what if I want to extend benefits and grandma was getting Social Security and she died? Well, no, I'll marry your corpse and then you can just keep sending the Social Security benefits my way. I know it sounds disgusting, but you know what? Guess what? It's Wild West out there at this point with this decision.
It's libertarian. Small L libertarianism run amok. Mm-hmm. You can have. Albert Mohler has called it erotic libertarianism. In other words, you can do anything you want, sexually speaking. And that wraps into marriage.
And I believe it was R.J. Rushdoony who wrote a great book that you can probably still get. We might still have copies of it in our Amazon store. It's called The Politics of Pornography. And it's an interesting book written by a theologian philosopher who basically assumed that these are the type of things we'd be heading to.
Right.
When we reject God and cast him off from being the source of law and being the source of the moral fiber and understanding that we have in this culture. And so I would strongly recommend, if you want to read a very interesting read, it's called The Politics of Pornography. So I think they renamed it now. If you go to chalcedon.edu, which is the home website for Rushdoony's ministry.
I think we have a link
I think they named it Noble Savages or something like that, because having the word pornography was probably turning a lot of people off from wanting to order it.
Oh, no. Actually, what it does is it gets you kicked out of a lot of...
libraries?
No. Not so much that. Off websites.
Well, that's
you put
true.
The title on, and there are people that will automatically... automatically block it. So, and a lot of bookstores will actually block it as well, because it's assumed that if it says pornography, it is pornography. Mm-hmm. Well... it's not. It's philosophy.
I believe that the new title, the redone title, is called Noble Savages.
Okay.
So anyhow, that's a great book. And this was written in the 70s, Chuck.
Yeah.
So 40 years ago, after the Stonewall Riots, after Roe v. Wade, Rushdoony saw what was coming and what was going to happen to this culture.
Yeah. And if you want to read a more prescient author than Rushdoony, good luck. Rushdoony was amazing in his, and it wasn't the fact that he was a prophet. It was the fact that he was like the men of Issachar, who knew the times and knew what to do. He could read the culture and see what was coming. And he was also he was a presuppositionalist, as we started out at the beginning of the. In fact, he was a student of one of the developers of presuppositional apologetics, and that's Van Til.
Mm-hmm.
Van Til.
Cornelius Van Til.
Cornelius Van Til. And Greg Bonson, of course, was the guy who made it him easy to understand. Because if you ever try to read Van Til, Cornelius Van Til was Dutch. And English was his second language. And I will tell you, folks, that people who have learned Dutch have told me it's really hard. And translating it from Dutch to English is really, really, really hard. So that's where that goes. We can see a number of things coming down the pike based on what went on in Obergefell. Now, what's interesting about John Roberts is he was decrying the lack of a bright line. And unfortunately, Roberts is double-minded, because in the Obamacare decision, just a few days before the Obergefell decision, he had used some of the exact same arguments in favor of Obamacare.
Yes, yes, he
that
had.
that the proponents, the pro votes on Obergefell used in terms of marriage. So, unfortunately, everybody who thought John Roberts was going to be the big savior, A, wasn't paying attention. B, did not understand that he's a double-minded man, and a double-minded man is unstable in all his ways.
That's right.
But he's not the only one. Because, you know, we started out this hour talking about a presentation that I watched put out by my church's insurance company. Well, I'm not going to give you the name of the company, and we're not going to play snippets of the thing just to make sure that nobody gets mad at us, because I didn't have permission to play snippets. We could do fair use, but I don't want to fight that fight.
Especially not with an insurance company.
Not with an insurance company. Even one as godly as the particular insurance company involved, which, by the way, is, I think, either the largest or one of the largest in the country. But what we saw from them, they basically came out and set up this seminar. It was a webinar with a man who is, and I'm not going to mention his name, but he's a Harvard Law graduate and he's a Harvard Divinity School attendee. I don't know if he got a degree or not.
Yeah. And from I heard the audio, he sounds older, so
he's 50, yeah. 50, 55-ish. And I can tell you that from virtually the opening gun when this man started to talk, the information that we got was obfuscatory.
Shaded a little.
Yeah, I would say obfuscatory. In other words, obfuscation. Obfuscation is hiding the facts.
Yes, it is.
To make an argument. Now, what he's basically... He's playing the company tune on the company pipe regarding federal court decisions. In other words, he's an attorney. He's playing the game and telling us things that were simply not true.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
For instance... I'll give you a quick for instance. I have one of his slides up. There, of course, the landmark decision, 5-4 on June 26, 2015, was a 5-4 decision. Due process and equal protection clauses, and there it is. That's the 14th Amendment.
That's exactly what it is.
Now, this is according to Anthony Kennedy, who was actually one of the pro votes. And this is the guy who was the swing vote. Everybody was hoping Anthony Kennedy would come over to the right side on marriage. And it turned out that he did not. And not surprisingly, anybody who knows what Anthony Kennedy was about, in fact, there is some information starting to come out now. Barry, who appointed Anthony Kennedy?
I believe that was Ronaldus Magnus.
That's right. Ronald Reagan appointed Anthony Kennedy. And so let's right now put to bed the myth that conservative Republicans are going to give us conservative judges. Because, yes, John Roberts voted the correct way on this particular case, but how did he vote on the Obamacare decision?
Well, horribly twice.
And who?
Twice.
And who appointed him?
Let me think. John Roberts would have been W.
Number 43.
George
That's
W. Right. George W.
So
Bush.
let's put to bed the myth. Also, Sandra Day O'Connor was given to us by Ronald Reagan. Again, not a conservative.
Not by any stretch of the imagination.
No, basically, we did get Scalia and we did get Alito. Alito came from W.
Yes. Yeah. He appointed both of them.
Gosh, I thought Scalia came earlier than that, and I'll tell you why. Because he's about 80 some years old, so these guys are not going to last too much longer. In any case, again, equal protection clause of the 14th Amendment. So, in other words, the equal protection clause and the due process clause override the rest of the Constitution. Can that possibly be?
It can be only if you're asleep at the switch and don't understand that the Constitution is an organic whole and it has to all work together. You can't have one small section of the Constitution completely override the entire rest of the document, because if you even think of Article 6, the Supremacy Clause, which we've talked about on this program numerous times, how does it say the supreme law of the land is? the Constitution of the United States. That doesn't mean just the four. It doesn't just say the 14th Amendment. The Constitution of the United States and the laws of the United States made in pursuance thereof. In other words, and all treaties entered into under the authority of the United States are the supreme law of the land. Didn't say the 14th Amendment and then the Constitution if it doesn't violate the 14th Amendment. See, that's the problem. It's a backwards logic. We're saying that that's a part to whole fallacy, that the part defines the whole.
That's right.
Instead of the whole
defining the part.
And framing and buttressing the part. And
now,
I'm glad you brought that. If you don't mind.
No, be my guest.
I'm going to go wild back in the fields of the Lord here for just a couple of seconds.
Remind me to go back to Anthony Kennedy because what he said was important.
Well, I want you to get Anthony Kennedy, but I want everybody to get this because we talk about the 14th Amendment, but very few people know what it says.
That's right.
And this is the portion of the 14th Amendment. Because there are five sections to the 14th Amendment.
Right.
But it's only section one.
Four of them are defunct.
Four of them are basically defunct. That's right. Well, three of them are. Well, the last one is giving Congress the power to do whatever they feel like,
yeah.
Which the court actually has taken over doing that because Congress won't. But here's section one. This is what it says specifically. This is the language. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. Period. Okay, that's the first sentence. Is that ambiguous, Chuck?
That's pretty clear.
That's very clear. Okay. Second sentence in section one. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Period. Okay, that's the second part. That's where this equal protection and due process stuff comes in.
Right.
Did you catch something in that? Okay. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of
citizens of the United States. Yeah.
However, within their own state, they may make laws as long as those laws don't deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. See, there's two parts to that clause. And yeah. Nobody talks about this, but there are two parts to that clause. The privileges and immunities is of citizens of the United States, which is anybody who's not a citizen of the United States and a resident and a citizen of the state in which they reside. In other words, non-residents. So I can't, as a non-resident, I don't lose my right to drive my car when I cross over into West Virginia because I hold an Ohio driver's license. Because that's a privilege that I have in the state in wherein I reside because I'm also a citizen. Because being a citizen of that state, I'm also a citizen of the United States. So I can drive across the country without worrying them about them throwing me in jail because they're saying that I'm driving on a license that they don't recognize.
Yeah, and that has been tried, by the way, by some.
I know it has been tried. Yeah. But in my state, they cannot take away my life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction. Okay, do you understand what that means? In its jurisdiction.
Yeah.
So which persons are they talking about here? They're talking about the citizens of the states in that jurisdiction. The equal protection of the law. So in other words, we don't try somebody, like if two people commit a crime, the people within the state and somebody without outside the state comes into the state and helps commit the crime, you don't try them under two separate sets of rules. There isn't a in-state rule and an out-of-state rule that you try them under. They're tried under the same set of rules. But the point is that this whole idea about privileges and immunities is that a state can't basically say to somebody from another state, well, we won't recognize the fact that you are a free individual, and if you come into our state, remember this is fugitive slave law time.
Right.
You come into our state, we're going to imprison you because you crossed over our border. That's what this is about. It's not about who I love and whether or not I feel like mutually committed
right.
to somebody of the same gender. That's not what the 14th Amendment has ever been about.
No, and you can see that in the... There's a great book by a guy named Raoul Berger.
Uh-huh, absolutely. I've got that book.
Yeah, Government by Judiciary.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's about the 14th Amendment. Essentially, he talks about the debates and those kinds of things. The 14th Amendment has been so abused to guarantee all these things and things and things and things. And it's one of the problems I've run into, and I've talked to, I've had online discussions with attorneys. And one of the things you learn when you learn the United States Constitution is that attorneys are really kind of not very bright about the Constitution. And there's a reason for that. And the worst ones of all, I hate to say this, and this is going to make some guys mad, the worst ones of all are constitutional attorneys. They really don't know anything about it.
Yeah, because they've studied case law.
They've studied case law. And I got into a discussion recently with somebody who insisted that the Supremacy Clause meant everything. It means that basically the federal government can do anything it wants to. So I basically asked this person the question. I said, okay, so what you're telling me is that in Articles 1 through 5, the federal government is effectively handcuffed. But in Article 6, the handcuffs come back off, so they can do anything they want. But in Articles 1 through 10, the handcuffs go back on.
That's what you're trying to tell
you. Is that correct? Basically, after I asked that question, and again, that's a presuppositional question.
Yes, well, yes, it is.
This person didn't want to play anymore.
I wonder why.
Because basically, at that point, I had essentially completely disrupted her presuppositional framework. That is really not that difficult to learn how to do. And in fact, now somebody would come back. I mean, this person did try to come back and tell me, giving me constitutional interpretation of all these quote unquote scholars. And I go, I don't care what the scholars say. I honestly don't. It doesn't matter. What does the text of the Constitution say?
Oh, that's but that doesn't matter.
Barry, it's the same argument we get with the Bible.
Yeah.
You know, this pulling things out of context and saying, see, it means this. No, it doesn't. You have to read the document as a whole.
Yes, you do.
You know, God hated somebody over here, but he loved the same person over there and blah, blah, blah. God wouldn't do this and he wouldn't do that. This is where we get into trouble that the testaments are separate because the God of the Old Testament was mean and vindictive and the God of the New Testament, Jesus, is loving and kind. And I'm like, Jesus talked about hell a lot. And he talked about how people were going to go there a lot.
Very lot, yes.
That is judgmental. Yes. Was Jesus being judgmental? Oh, you betcha he was. Because he's supposed to be. So one of the problems you run into here is that lawyers who don't know the Constitution construct arguments based on phrases pulled out of context. This is why we get on the First Amendment talk. And this is actually relevant to what we're about to talk about. We get people who talk about separation of church and state. Well, separation of church and state is nowhere in the First Amendment. What is in there is a prohibition for the creation of the establishment of a national church.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did that mean that Christianity could not be given a supreme position? And the answer is no. Because when you study what all that meant, when you study it all,
mm-hmm.
what it meant was no single denomination would be named the national denomination. You have to remember, these guys had just come out from under England. And what was the national denomination in England? It was
Anglican.
Anglicanism.
That's right.
The Church of England. And what that meant was, and what a lot of people don't know, one of the spark plugs of the revolution, one of the things that lit the match, that lit the fuse, was the fact that King George III demanded that all churches report to an Anglican bishop.
Yep, that's true. And that didn't set well with many of the Scotch-Irish Presbyterians or
Catholics
or Baptists.
Lutherans. Even Quakers.
Quakers
didn't like it either. Congregationalists didn't like it. Nobody liked it. The only people that liked it were Anglicans, and most of them didn't really like it because they understood what it meant.
Nope, that's right.
And contrary to popular opinion, Anglicans weren't the majority here. Congregationalists, probably. Calvinists, some form of Calvinism. Even Quakers are Calvinists. They're kind of a strange form of Calvinism, but they're Calvinists. Could you see a Lutheran pastor reporting to an Anglican bishop? It's not going to happen.
No.
Not going to happen.
No, that would be asking far too much, I think.
Yeah. So let's go back for a second then to what Anthony Kennedy said.
Sure, please.
Because what he said was, religious organizations and pastors especially, remember, this is a majority decision in Obergefell.
Right.
May continue to advocate and teach.
Oh, thank you so much.
Oh, gosh. Now, what the dissenting judges, and Roberts was among these, said, what about practice and the exercise of religion? Because the majority decision left out that part of the constitutional... Mm-hmm.
Yes, it did.
The constitutional guarantee. What they said was they can continue to advocate and teach. Now, what is that saying? Again, we talked about this Radical Two Kingdoms thing. Radical Two Kingdoms idea is that basically your faith applies inside the walls of your church and nowhere else.
Right, exactly.
It's not supposed to color your... It can color your viewpoint, but you're not supposed to use it as a quote-unquote club or a lever in political discussion. Now, that's not what the First Amendment says.
Never has been.
And it never has been. Separation of church and state is not even in the Constitution. It's from a private letter between the Darenberry Baptist Association and Thomas Jefferson. And guess what they're asking Jefferson to do? Use the power of the federal government to intervene in a state established church versus a Baptist church.
Uh-huh.
Basically, the Baptists wanted some state money.
Yeah,
just like the, I believe Congregationalism was the established, it might have been Episcopalianism, but in any case, Connecticut had an established church, and they wanted some of the money, and they wanted protection from the state government. And Thomas Jefferson, that wall of separation between church and state, really, if you know any biology at all, it was a semi-permeable membrane. And what that means is...
Don't know much biology.
That's right. What that means is that things can pass one direction through it, but not the other.
Exactly.
And what he was saying was, yeah, the church can have an influence on the state,
but the state
can't
the
interfere in the churches.
State should never interfere in the churches.
Exactly.
But we've thrown that off because, hey, now we have the state interfering in the churches, which gets right to our point of the briefing that you churchmen received from an organization that has its own financial bottom line at interest in this.
Yeah, exactly. And let's not forget that. Basically, what they're trying to do is avoid making payouts.
Right.
Now, okay, fine. That actually keeps rates low. So nobody's going to squawk that your insurance company is doing its best to keep rates low. However, they are supposed to be acting as a shield. And when you get legal advice that's basically telling you,
you don't have a shield.
You don't have a shield because basically... The implied threat in the presentation was, at the end, was you shouldn't be doing things like renting your church out for weddings to people who aren't members.
Okay. Because no, I understand that.
I understand it. However, let me tell you something. My daughter just got married in a church that wasn't ours.
And you weren't members then. That's
and right. We weren't members of. Now, her grandmother was, and actually her mother and I also got married in that church.
So you had some loose connection to it.
We had some loose connection to it. However, we did rent. We had to pay rent. And what they were saying was, you should stop doing that to protect yourself. Because then you're letting yourself in for a discrimination suit. And I'm like, wait a minute. Now, at the same time, they were recommending that you not change your bylaws.
What?
Yeah. They were if you heard at the end part, don't change your bylaws to put certain things in there, because then that could open you up to a discrimination suit.
That makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. Well, so don't change your bylaws so they can come at you for discrimination, but it change your bylaws and they'll come at you for discrimination. In other words, what they're hat tipping and admitting implicitly is, doesn't matter what you do, suits are coming.
Yeah. Well, bottom line is, yeah. This guy attempted, there was so much falsehood in what he said that it's difficult to accept much of what he said as having a lot of value. Now, let's get into some of the minutiae. He claims that prior to the Supreme Court's decision, 37 states and the District of Columbia had provisions making same-sex marriages lawful. Is that correct?
Actually, no, it's not. Well, let's put it this way. It's technically accurate, but it's not correct on the point. The point is that when he spoke that, or when he looked that up, it was after the United States Supreme Court had denied cert on two different cases coming from two different circuits, both of which the lower court ruling said you must, whether you've got an amendment or not, or you recognize traditional marriage, you must recognize and support and endorse and, you know, issue licenses for gay marriage. And when it was appealed to the Supreme Court denied cert on those. We don't want to hear those. We agree with the circuit court's ruling.
Exactly.
And that effectively shut the door and forced the circuit court ruling upon these other states. Now, if I remember correctly, I believe there were only six states prior to those appeals who actually had actively created a state same-sex marriage, whether it was your Connecticut with your domestic partnerships or Massachusetts or I think Nevada.
Vermont. Hawaii.
Hawaii had finally done one. And I forget where else. I mean, there was a couple other states. Six or seven states were the only ones who recognized same-sex marriage. Now, when these two circuit court decisions came up and the Supreme Court denied cert on those appeals, that forced 30-plus other states to have to recognize it or be in violation of the court. That was before the Obergefell decision. So that quote from your insurance attorney isn't actually true.
Again, because it's disingenuous.
Those states had not willfully embraced and had extended as part of their state laws. As a matter of fact, I don't believe any of them have actually changed their state laws to reflect.
That's the whole point. According to him, this is the quote. Prior to Supreme Court's decision, 37 states and the District of Columbia had provisions making same-sex marriages lawful.
Yeah, those provisions were court rulings telling them that they couldn't not.
Now, he claims the court's decision invalidates laws and constitutional provisions in 13 states defining marriage solely as a union between a man and a woman. Wrong. It changed. Okay, perhaps not all states had a specific statement that a marriage was between a man and a woman. However, tacitly, that is, unspokenly, 44 states required marriage and defined marriage as one man, one woman.
Correct. Absolutely. And four of those states being the four whose cases were combined in the Obergefell
decision, exactly,
which were the Sixth Circuit states of Ohio, Tennessee, Michigan, and Kentucky.
Yeah. So basically, this is frankly utter nonsense. And one of the things this lawyer claims is that the states had passed these provisions. And what he implied was that all the states that have these quote-unquote provisions, not just the six that we're talking about that passed them, passed protections for pastors and churches so they wouldn't have to perform these things. He's claiming that all of the states have these provisions. Well, no.
No, it's not true.
It's six, because it's the only six that have passed laws recognizing same-sex marriage. So out of 50, he's claiming that a majority of them, and it's only six. So again, really stunningly bad information.
Oh, absolutely. I feel for, I mean, Chuck, you know, you're a church officer. Your church, you've alerted your elders and your pastor to the flaws in this presentation. How many other churches were on this presentation? Because this insurance company is a big one. They're one of the largest in the country, and they represent thousands of churches. I know. Our insurance in my church is through that same company.
I honestly think we need to get together and say, this presentation was so deeply flawed, you need to clarify.
Oh, absolutely. I don't disagree with that in a bit.
Now, he asked the question, will ministers be legally required to perform same-sex marriages? Will churches be required to host same-sex marriages on church property? He gives an explanation that is, shall we say, less than comforting. He basically talks about the idea that, you know, these pastors, there are laws protecting them in these states that have these provisions. And again, we just went over that. He claims it's unlikely that ministers will be legally required to perform same-sex marriages. Here's what he says. Previous SCOTUS rulings suggest clergy will be free to decline to marry same-sex couples without penalty or civil liability. First Amendment's protection of religious freedom is robust with regard to clergy performance of sacerdotal functions. That's things like communion and baptisms and those kinds of dedications,
right,
those
exactly.
kinds of things,
exactly.
Marriages. Prior to SCOTUS decision, clergy was able to refuse to perform marriages on religious grounds, that is, marriages in which one or both members were not members of the faith or have been previously married and divorced. Here's a key point. Now, this is what his big bulwark that he's depending on. No minister has been sued, much less found liable for not performing such marriages. In other words, there's no precedent. There's no precedent for it. Every state that recognized same-sex marriage included accommodations for the right of clergy to refuse to perform marriage. That's six. Mm-hmm. That's six out of 50.
Yes,
okay.
Right.
Now, the other ones are left dangling.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's not a comfortable provision.
Guess what? Now, he implied that that's going to be everybody. It's not. Now, the other key thing he talked about was the fact that the precedent is that there's no precedent that's going to require that. And it never has been. And you know what I say to that? There's no precedent for homosexual marriage before 1994.
That's true. Absolutely.
So my reply to that is, if you're counting on that as a defense, good luck. You may have 20 years. Maybe.
Maybe. I doubt it.
The way things are moving, I doubt it. Because if you recall, the Hawaii thing didn't fly. When it got done in 94.
Right.
Didn't fly. And when Mitt Romney did it, and yes, folks, Mitt Romney is the reason there was homosexual marriage in Massachusetts, and they were the first ones. Yes, the Massachusetts Supreme Court did say that the prohibition was unconstitutional, but it's in the Massachusetts Constitution that the court cannot change the law. So, how was the Massachusetts law changed? Mitt Romney, the great conservative, Mitt Romney, issued an executive order requiring clerks to issue marriage licenses to homosexual couples. And he claimed he was complying with it with a Massachusetts court decision. Wrong. Because Massachusetts courts can't change the law.
That's true. That's absolutely the case. Because the other part of Article 6 of the United States Constitution, the second half of that, says that the constitutions and courts of the states cannot override the Constitution of the United States, the laws of the United States made in pursuance thereof, and any treaties made under the authority of the United States.
So, honestly, Barry, we're not even halfway through this presentation, and it's such an embarrassment that I'm really shocked that anybody would have put this out.
Well, I think this is one of those things where they probably felt like they had to do something, since we're now sitting here almost 3 months from the decision coming out. We have the situation with Kim Davis happening in Kentucky, and the fact that the church is starting to wake up on this issue. So they are thinking that they're going to end up with some exposure and liability issues, and so it's time to tamp it down and get everybody to maybe meekly stay in their pews and try to let the culture go by them.
Listen to this. Here's what he quotes, and I'm just reinforcing, and we're going to run out of time here pretty quick, but
sure.
37 states previously recognized same-sex marriages. No, they did not.
No, absolutely
six
not.
Six states previously recognized same-sex marriages. And in most states, there was an explicit and unequivocal recognition of the right of clergy to marry or not marry any couple on the basis of their religious beliefs. I want to see a list, and I want to see the text of these supposed guarantees. Because I'll be quite honest, I don't think they exist.
Well, I think you're probably right about that, because I don't think they do either.
And here's from the Roberts dissenting opinion. Respect for sincere religious conviction has led voters and legislators in every state that has adopted same-sex marriage, that's six, democratically to include accommodations for religious practice, which can be wiped away with a single...
Can I tell you what those accommodations are? That's what's being enveloped in Indiana and in Utah and in other states as part of ENDA legislation.
Right.
The Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which is the next push for the homosexual rights movement. Basically, what they're going to say is, yeah, pastors, you get an exemption, but the way the language, if I remember the Ohio language from last session when they tried to push that, the religious exemption, Chuck, wouldn't have supported its own weight if it were a piece of wood, okay? It's worthless. It's got huge holes in it, and honestly, it'll put more churches and pastors in harm's way than if you just do nothing.
I'll be quite honest. He gives a list of a few of the, and I'll be quite honest, the text of these things is not particularly strong. An official of a religious order who fails or refuses to join individuals in marriage is not subject to any fine or other penalty. Okay, that's fine. That can be wiped out with a single decision of a court. And believe me, there are activist judges out there who can be sought out by homosexual activists or polygamous activists or name one to get the job done. So... ladies and gentlemen, we've kind of skated around on a number of topics, but these are important topics. And honestly, this is the first of three presentations, and I'm hoping the rest of them get better than this, because this was frankly awful. It was not well done. And I'll be quite honest, it's my opinion that the attorney that gave it is hoping someday, as a Harvard Law graduate, to sit on a federal bench.
That could be a
so he's not going to rock the boat and say this is a steaming load. It's he's not going to do that. And we need to talk a little more at some point, and probably not the next show or anything, but about what churches really should be doing.
Well, I understand that their next webinar that they're holding for you folks is coming up in early October. Let's hear that, and then let's come back to this issue and talk about what churches really ought to be doing, because the Alliance Defending Freedom has entire packets on what churches can and should be doing in this case.
And it's a very different kettle of fish than was presented in this presentation. Very, very different.
Absolutely.
So, all right, that's it. We're out of time for this week. Come out to the website, www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.